Good morning. I'm Lisa Wise, registration 27553. I'm a public defender. I represent David Torres. The smoking gun in this case is that the perpetrator had a distinctive vertical scar under his nose. So the question is, how was the defendant convicted when he has no such scar, especially in a case where there are no fingerprints, no DNA, no weapons were recovered, the proceeds from the robbery were never found, and there are no disguises that were ever found, especially when the defendant had an alibi and one eyewitness looked at the photo array in this case and looked at the defendant's photograph and said, I know for sure it's not him. So the answer comes down to the eyewitness identification that was made by the owner of the residence in this home. And here's his initial description. He said, Hispanic male, 5'5", stocky, wearing a hoodie, ski mask covering the mouth and nose, and a mustache. So that's kind of the first red flag there, which is how could he see the mustache if the mouth and nose are covered by the ski mask? So setting that aside for a moment, looking at the rest of the description, there's no eye color, no hair color, no facial features, and the description conflicted with that of the other witnesses, and it was very vague. The only thing the witnesses agreed to was that this was a Hispanic male. It's natural that the description was vague because the individuals who were robbed in this case had a very poor opportunity to see the robbers. They were told to lay on the floor face down and not to look at the robbers. They were told to look at the wall and point their faces away from the robbers and that they would be hurt if they looked at the robbers. And the robbers were both wearing masks and hoodies that covered substantially all of their faces. Also, there was a weapon used in this case, which creates an issue of weapon focus, and everybody who was present at this poker party was either drinking or smoking marijuana or both. And the witness that I'm focusing on today admitted that he was smoking marijuana earlier that evening.
Ms. Wise, if I may interrupt you.
Sure.
Perhaps you can help me and drill down which issue are we going to focus on here? There's a serious identification issue. So we've got a possible suggestive lineup. We have a witness who is excluded. So fit me into a box here. Because I think there are different legal issues depending on which one I focus on.
Absolutely. I'm focusing on identification. Although, the issue that really gets to me is the exclusion of the defense evidence. And that sort of operates together with the identification issue because it was the inclusion of the unreliable identification issue combined with the exclusion of the defense evidence that would have provided an innocent explanation for why these two gentlemen look familiar to each other. And I think these two issues operating together really have sort of a combined prejudice that is relevant. But if there's another issue that you'd like me to address, please jump in.
Well, I was just trying to, because again, I hear your argument that there is, I have concerns, frankly, about the identification here, but if we're going to focus on the lineup, I guess maybe you can turn to that.
Jump to the lineup?
Yeah,
okay.
Because I think you've got to find that the lineup was, the photo array was suggested,
right.
And then if it was, then you get to the second issue of whether it's an independent basis, et cetera. Got the lineup to show up in front of me. I'm curious as to what you feel is suggestive. I guess you said bushy eyebrows is only one man with a Hispanic name. And I want you to push back here.
Sure.
I have to say, the gentlemen look relatively close in this photo. This looks like a pretty decent array to me.
Okay.
Push back, persuade me on
that. Okay, so does the array have to look like the defendant, the suspect, or does the array have to look like the description? And, there's a law that's going into effect July 1st, I'm sure you guys are aware of it, that says that the array has to look like the description. And under Bernal, when race is an overriding characteristic in the description, which it is in this case, then it is suggestive to include people who are not of that race. And that's what happened here. So even if you find that one person looks Caucasian in that lineup, okay, even if you think one or two people do not look, indigenously Hispanic, as was described in the Bernal Borghese cases, then that reduces the size of the array from 6 down to 5 or down to 4 or smaller. And as we know, 6 is pretty much the constitutional minimum, right? 6 is not presumptively unconstitutional, but you really don't want to go below that. When you start going below that, things that jump out at you are exaggerated and heightened and make more of a difference.
Ms.
So the
Weiss.
Fact that these people look like Mr. Torres doesn't help me. It's do they look Hispanic? Do they look like the description?
Ms. Weiss, you argue in your brief that several of the people in the array do not have Hispanic names, but does the record indicate whether they were or were not Hispanic?
Other than the names, no, we don't know. We really don't know. So you just kind of have to look at the photographs and tell what would you have looked at this array and thought, does this match the description that was given?
So I gather from what you're saying that our test is to look at the pictures in the array to see if they're similar, not whether somebody is Hispanic because he has a Hispanic last name. Is that correct?
You have to look to see if they're Hispanic, because under Bernal, if race is an overriding characteristic in the description, then it's suggestive to include people in the array who do not look to be of that race.
Right. No, I understand that. But there, as you well know, there are people who may be Hispanic or partly Hispanic who don't have Hispanic last names.
Absolutely. And that was acknowledged in Bernal. And the eyewitness in this case did not have access to the names. So that's true. That's true. It's not based on the names. It's based on the appearance. However, if you look at it, I would not look at that array and say everybody in this array is Hispanic. And when the description is Hispanic male, then everybody in that array has to be Hispanic. Now, it might not have made a difference if the eyewitness was asked to look at a suspect booking photos that included hundreds of photographs. But here, there are only 6 photos. And when you narrow it down to make it so small, then you really have to make sure everybody in the photograph looks Hispanic.
Ms. Weiss, you initially articulated one of your concerns was that the initial description was fairly vague.
Yes.
And amounted just to stocky Hispanic.
Right.
So if you're saying that all the photos in the array merely have to be stocky Hispanic men, then possibly they could not look much alike, yet all be stocky Hispanic men.
That's not the only thing, though, because one photo can't jump out, right? There's a lot of factors in suggestiveness. You don't just look at one thing or the other. One thing you look at is everyone Hispanic? Another thing you look at is, does one photo jump out? That's a separate factor.
And do you think one photo in this one jumps out?
Well, I think the Caucasian people definitely. The one guy, Jeremy Howell, on the top left, I mean, he's a white guy, okay? He does not look like the description. This is at least 5-person array. There's a Middle Eastern guy on the bottom right corner, and that's just me. That's how it looks like to me. Those people do not look Hispanic to me.
Well, generally, it's if the defendant's photo jumps out. Say, for example, their background is a substantially different color than the other 5.
Right.
Or, you know, they've got some pencil markings on the photo and the other ones don't. But here you're saying just because maybe 2 other ones would be somewhat different, that somehow
right.
that focuses the attention on the defendant.
Well, yes, because those other people are excluded because they don't match the description. The person, the eyewitness who's looking at this array is looking for a Hispanic person. And if these other people do not look Hispanic, then the size of the array shrinks. And the pool of potential candidates for being identified shrinks. And when the pool shrinks down less than 6, you have a constitutional problem because you can't go much smaller than 6. 6 is already small. Size of the array is one large factor, and it's already small as it is.
Ms. Weiss, I know you raised a lot of issues in your brief. I was wondering if you could address the 404B issue for us, please.
Well, I made a chart in the brief that shows how I believe that they're different. You know, a lot can happen in 8 years. There were 8 years that spanned between the first robbery and the second robbery. The first robbery happened when Mr. Torres was a very young man, before he had a family and kids, and a lot can happen in these 8 years. And there's no evidence that these robberies were at all similar, because the Chinese restaurant robbery was motivated by revenge. They were walking outside the restaurant right before it happened and just kind of with no masks on, so the patrons saw them with their faces. And then they walked in, there was only one weapon used. The people in the restaurant were not robbed. I thought that was very significant because in this home invasion robbery, everybody on the premises was robbed and told to lay down, don't look at the robbers. Whereas in the Chinese restaurant robbery, the perpetrator said, don't worry, ma'am, you know, your kids are not going to be hurt. We're not going to hurt anybody. We just want to take the money and go out the back door. The home invasion robbery was much more bold. It was a front door entry. It was much more violent. Nobody was hurt in the Chinese restaurant robbery, and they ended up going home afterwards, whereas in this case, Mr. Torres, his home was searched immediately after the robbery, and none of the proceeds from the robbery were found there. Nothing, no disguises. Could I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please?
Oh, certainly you may. You have 4 minutes and 51 seconds.
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Regarding the issue, the identification, there was no problem with this based upon two reasons. First of all, the photo array shows six individuals who look reasonably similar in key variables, those being eyes, facial features, age, and hairstyle. Thus, there was no due process violation. Second, even if this court concludes that the array was suggestive, it was otherwise reliable under Neal versus Biggers. Regarding the issue of three gentlemen in the array being Hispanic, first of all, the Constitution does not care about labels, except insofar as it affects key variables such as hair color, hairstyle, skin tone, variables such as that. That was made clear in the Bernal opinion when it cited to Williams versus Weldon, which said that you could even have suspects of a different race in a lineup and there's no due process violation as long as the individuals look reasonably similar. And that is exactly what is in this case. We have six individuals who look reasonably similar. The police testified that they went through great lengths to ensure that there was no problem with the photos. Not only did the detective look at it, he had an individual personnel within the police department help generate the array. They rechecked it, and based upon all the variables for key facial features, the six photographs do satisfy due process. Furthermore, the defendant made an issue regarding the scar. It should be pointed out to the court, at least, that the scar was in fact not necessarily the victim's first description of what that particular distinguishing facial characteristic was. He first described it as kind of like a scar on the lip, or at one point even said, I don't know what that is. It obviously has some kind of distinguishing characteristic to him that he was able to identify the suspect from the array, and whatever it was, he was able to pick out Mr. Torres in the lineup itself.
How was he able to do that if Mr. Torres had a mask on?
Well, the question becomes is what necessarily was the mask covering? There was differing testimony about that. First of all, there was a description that the mask covered the mouth only and that the eyes and nose were exposed. Mr. Victorino, the victim in this case, was also able to identify him from his eyes and also one characteristic that he described as the maturity on his face. There was no further testimony regarding what he meant by that, but based upon that, that's a finding of fact that this court can rely upon to say that the identification in this case was in fact satisfactory and it satisfied due process. Furthermore, even if this court was to conclude that there were problems with the array itself, the six photographs, the identification itself did satisfy the test under Neal versus Biggers, the five factors in that particular case. Mr. Victorino had an opportunity to view the suspect. It should be mentioned that when these assailants entered the house, they called for Mr. Victorino specifically, and they brought him around the house. He had opportunities to turn around, and look at these individuals. Of course, they ordered him to turn back around. They didn't want to be seen. But this exposure happened over a period of time lasting up to approximately 15 minutes. His degree of attention was heightened by this incident. He said it was very traumatic, very stressful. A gun was involved. And he also said that he, in fact, was not intoxicated during this particular event. The defendant has indicated a number of factors that would go to the description of the suspect that would create problems, but there were also a number of factors that were involved that weighed in favor of his identification being satisfactory. Again, the eyes, the eyebrows, the nose, this particular facial feature that was ultimately described as a scar. There was also the additional issue of the level of certainty. Mr. Victorino said that his identification, that he felt very confident in identifying. He immediately pointed him off from the lineup. The detective testified that the Mr. Victorino also identified him immediately. And further, there's the issue of the time between when the crime occurred and when the identification occurred. It was only 2 days.
Mr. Fisher, maybe you should address the 404B in relationship to the defense of misidentification.
Regarding the 404B, there was no problem with that. The court conducted a full SPOTO test to determine whether it was admissible, and at least according to the court's analysis, it satisfied the preponderance of evidence standard.
Well, let me interrupt you, Mr. Fisher, to make sure I understand. The court let this in for common plan or scheme and identification, correct?
That's correct.
How does an 8-year-old burglary show a common plan or scheme under very different circumstances?
They're not necessarily different, and there's six factors here that weigh in favor of the 404 or satisfying the 404B.
Well, I'm asking a more specific question. To me, a common plan or scheme means it's part of one plan, one kind of thing. These are 8 years apart. His wife described the differences in the crimes. I'm having a lot of trouble seeing how this is a common plan, and where's the limit? 12 years ago, 15 years ago, person commits a robbery, is that a common plan?
It depends on the facts and circumstances and looking at the two crimes.
So tell me why this was a common plan or scheme.
First of all, obviously the two crimes involved armed robbery. Second, both crimes involved firearms and the defendant was armed in both of them.
Excuse me, it sounds like you said the same thing twice.
Well, it was armed robbery, the defendant was armed with a firearm. In both of these. In other words, you could be armed with a variety of instruments.
Okay.
But he was using a firearm specifically in these crimes.
I understand.
Third, the defendant robbed two separate victims at locations where he had prior measurable contact. In other words, this wasn't a crime of opportunity, someone down the street and taking advantage of a situation or casing a location from afar. In other words, he had personal contact with these locations prior to actually robbing them. Fourth, the locations were both places of business. One was legitimate, one was an illegitimate drug trade. Fifth, the defendant used a partner in both the crimes. And sixth, the defendant concealed his face in both the robberies.
So don't those apply to about 80% of the robberies? I mean, that's my concern. You describe things as very general. I could give you 100 hypotheticals. 40 years ago, a guy commits a crime with an accomplice, he has a gun, it's a place of business, and he has some connection. Where's the limit of common plan? And that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm a little bit trouble, but I want you to push back on me.
I understand.
But I'm having trouble seeing a common plan because there were some identifying factors that were similar. I think of common plan as, this was a series of robberies or whatever. We kind of got together and we're going to now rob a series of banks. John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde maybe come up with a common plan just because they had a series of them. This one is a little harder for me. So get me past just you've identified things that are somewhat similar. I think they're pretty general. How does that show a common plan or a scheme here?
Well,
common seems to have been written out of your definition.
Well, I would argue that how many common variables do you have until you actually have something where you say, this is his MO. This is the way he does these particular crimes. And that's the problem, is that if it was one or two, yes, I would agree with you. That's a little too general. Here I've outlined six. And so you take six common variables, and then you say, this actually appears to be the way he does this particular crime.
Well, you've managed to identify six variables, but they all seem to be kind of general and could relate to any number of robberies. It's not anything distinct like, and he comes in wearing a Batman outfit or something like that. See what I'm saying? It's not those things that you're saying, used a firearm, was with an accomplice, put a ski mask over his face. I mean, these could relate to any number of robberies, even though there's six of them.
I understand. But again, it's how many common variables, when put together, do you have a distinct pattern with this particular defendant? And that's the issue that I'm trying to stress, is that, yes, it's true. There are people who conceal their face. There are people who use firearms in robberies. There are people who, you know, commit armed robberies with firearms. But again, it's how many of these common factors, when they come together.
Well, wouldn't you agree there's a lot of people that do all six, though? It's not particularly distinctive to do all six.
Not necessarily, though. The problem becomes is you don't have crimes or armed robberies that are committed with firearms all the time. You don't have armed robberies where an individual actually has physical contact with a location. In other words, there's plenty of opportunities where there's crimes of, where just walking down the street, a person commits an armed robbery, or actually looks from afar at a business and assesses it before actually committing the crime itself, not necessarily entering it. And again, it's just how many of these common variables, when you amass them all together, do you say, yes, individually looking at all these components, these would be nothing in particular unique or anything like that. But the fact that you have six of them outlined in this particular case should direct this court to say this is the way he conducts armed robberies.
If we should find that this evidence was improperly admitted, is there a harmless error argument?
There is a harmless error argument. First of all, there's the issue of the vehicle that was used in this particular case, which was a Dodge Neon. The tag number was obtained by the victim chasing this particular car out of the complex. It was traced back to a gentleman by the name of Joey Robert Sr. And he said, I've loaned that car long term to my nephew, Mr. Torres. Mr. Torres came up with an explanation when confronted initially by Mr. Robert, saying, I don't know anything about it. Then an hour later says, oh, the vehicle was stolen. And then the vehicle is found less than 2 miles from its residence with the back window broken out. Then there's a whole issue of Mr. Torres's statement to his, I believe it was his cousin, where he said that in fact he did commit this crime.
Although that was highly disputed. So the uncle says, the cousin told me that you admitted it. The cousin says, no, he didn't. We also have facts about this car, that there was a stepson who happened to have a distinctive scar, who arguably could have had access to the car too. It was his father's car. I mean, so the facts are all over the place.
Actually, I think, if you don't mind me correcting
you. Please.
Sure. Mr. Kusmal, who you're describing, has the distinct scar. He is not Mr. Robert's son.
Isn't he someone's stepson?
He's a stepson, yes.
Yeah.
And, yes, so, but not only that, but what we're talking about with Mr. Kusmal is, in fact, a distinct scar. There is no mistaking the fact that he had a scar based upon a cleft lip that was, in fact, corrected. There's no mistaking that, in fact, you would describe that particular mark as a scar. Again, what Mr. Victorino said was, I don't know what that mark is, but apparently it was distinct enough for him to make an identification in this case. So say that this particular mark that Mr. Kusmal had was something that he would describe as, I don't know what it is. It just doesn't seem to fit into how someone would describe that reasonably.
Sure, I guess I think you were arguing that the evidence was overwhelming, which is how this comes to be harmless, and I guess I'm not, I was pushing back a little because I'm not so sure. There are a lot of problems in this case with the identification and all the things we've described. So let me ask you, following up on harmless error, the prosecutor at trial did rely pretty heavily on this prior vote in closing argument, for example, right?
Well, I would say that the reliance is not as heavy as it has been portrayed by the defendant. According to my review of the transcript, yes, there were five witnesses, but all totaled, it was 66 pages of transcripts in four volumes, about 800, 1,000 pages So to say it was heavily relied upon, I think is not an appropriate description.
What about during argument?
It was relied upon during argument, yes.
So, Mr. Fisher, since your remaining time is very little, could you comment on the prosecutor's use of the word lie during closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. The issue with the word lie in this case is reviewed for plain error. And we're not going to say that that was necessarily proper. I mean, the case law says that the prosecutor should not use lie or liar or anything like that. I mean, the case law says that explicitly. But in this particular case, the defendant opened the door to that. Joey Herbert Jr. was portrayed, at least by the defendant, as someone who's trying to get back his father's good graces, has some kind of connection with marijuana, either in the trade itself or using it, and at least it was inferred that Mr. Herbert came up with this, or Mr. Herbert Jr., I should say, came up with this story to get back in his father's good graces.
So are there any cases that, of which you're aware, which is Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, that said that the use of the word lie is okay if the defendant has opened the door to that?
I'm not aware of it, Your Honor, but I will say that, again, reviewing it for plain error, which is a very lofty burden and a very lofty standard, based upon the facts of this case, there was no plain error.
Okay.
And if there are no further courts, we ask that you affirm the conviction of the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
I'd like to start with Justice Boras' question about whether the ID, whether the array has to focus right on that one defendant person, whether that defendant has to be the person that jumps out. And I was looking at Bernal and it says all that is required is that the photos are matched by race, age, facial hair, and other characteristics. So they have to be matched by race. So certainly if the defendant's race jumps out, then that's 1 in 6 and reversal is probably appropriate. In this case, the defendant jumps out because he's one of 3 Hispanics. So it doesn't jump out as significantly as it would if it was 1 in 6, but it still jumps out in its own way. It is not a 1 in 6 jump out, but a 1 in 3.
Ms. Weiss, how do we judge that? I know you said to you felt like the gentleman in the upper left looks Caucasian, the gentleman on the bottom right looks Middle Eastern. Is it an objective test? Who decides?
It's a question of law. So the application of facts to law, this court can apply it however it wants to, because it can look at the factors and weigh it differently from how the trial court did.
But does the trial judge look at it and say, that person looks Caucasian to me? I mean, what is the test?
We don't have a ton of guidance. Okay. We don't, but it just says they have to be matched by race, and I'm saying they're not.
What about if the names aren't on the lineup? Because I've seen plenty of lineups that don't have the names underneath, and somehow I think if you see the name and you're associating that name maybe with Middle Eastern heritage or Hispanic heritage, then that might cause you to view the picture in a different way.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, and that's exactly why the names are kind of probably withheld from the person who's looking at the array. However, I think this court can look at it as some circumstantial evidence of whether these people were matched by race and whether the detective who put this array together could have done maybe a better job. So the size of the array, this is just one factor, okay? The other factor that we didn't even get to is the manner of presentation and the fact that this eyewitness was threatened with arrest if he didn't come down and cooperate with this identification procedure. So that's another factor to consider. But I want to jump to the 404B because there are 5 witnesses who testified on this 404B. So this is a classic example of sideshow. Okay, this is not brief reference to you have a prior robbery, don't you? This was 5 witnesses, the lead detective, the sergeant, and 2 restaurant customers testified. And in closing argument, the prosecutor argued the defendant was identified in the prior robbery just like he was identified in this case. So by drawing the analogy to the identification procedure in this case and by bolstering it with the identification in the prior robbery, which was actually quite strong because the perpetrators had been observed while walking outside the restaurant with no masks. So the identifications were not of the same way, and to draw that analogy in this case was particularly harmful. And then finally, with respect to the closing argument and the defense inviting it, I would ask this court to look at People v. Wed, which is says that the use of prosecutor's words, use of the word lie in closing argument is categorically improper, and that and a defense lawyer who says that certain witnesses were inconsistent is just doing their job. That is not an invitation to prosecutorial misconduct. You cannot use the word lie, you just cannot do it, and at the time of this case, the law was clear on that issue. The evidence was not overwhelming. Again, there's no physical evidence. There are other people connected to this vehicle, specifically Joey, the son, Kyle, the stepson. The defendant presented an alibi, and Joey testified that there was no such admission. And it's not a confession. I would not call it a confession. It was not made to the police. It's not audio taped. This is a third-hand alleged admission that was carried through many people. Do you have any other questions?
I don't think so.
Okay. We can talk about identification more.
That's an interesting issue. Thank you, Your Honors. Have a nice morning.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. We very much appreciate both of your helpful arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. So.